roughly page 7. I'm going to use it for a few minutes, yeah. Yeah, we should turn off the top lights there. Thank you. Not those, those. That's worse. Help. Okay, is that okay? Okay. Okay, so thank you, everybody. Do we have everybody there? So what I thought I would do is just point to some provocative statements in a Tooks paper and really suggest you're reading it. And then I want to turn to Lewis Crane's paper and look at a portion of it. And then I'm going to explain what Lewis Crane is suggesting, because there's some interesting mathematics and it's relevant for the questions that we're discussing. Okay, so Tooke gives, of course, a more intelligent version of the argument that I've given. And just to show you that he's not kidding, he comes here. This is about page 7. Okay, well, if one could determine the equations of motion of these variables on the two-plane, one would also possess a remedy for the black hole information paradox. And then he talks about Rindler space. We haven't introduced Rindler space, so let me just skip this and just note the claim. The basic idea is that whether a black hole formed or evaporated or whatever was going on, the information would be coded on some two surface not included in the black hole. So even if a, you know, if the two surface is here and you would want to use a two surface not too near the black hole, and the black hole forms here and evaporates and whatever, all the real information that you need to predict the precise future state is contained on this two surface here, and it just goes chugging along on the two surface. Okay. Then he says the infinite correlations in three space, that is, there have to be a hidden infinite amount of correlations between the values of the degrees of freedom seen as field degrees of freedom in three space for all that information to actually be represented by much fewer information on the two surface. So there have to be many hidden correlations. The infinite correlations in three space could also present a new starting point for resolving the Einstein-Rosen-Podolsky paradox. In terms of present-day quantum field theory degrees of freedom, it is not possible to interpret quantum mechanics deterministically. But certain cellular automata models can give a faint resemblance to quantum behavior. By that, he means you can set up a cellular automata where waves propagate through the values of the... Does everybody know what a cellular automata is? A cellular automata is a discrete system, say, on the two-plane, it would be a system of pixels, so discrete degrees of freedom in every pixel on and off, and it updates in a series of time steps, and the new value of a pixel is some deterministic function of the values of the pixels adjacent to it. And so there's some deterministic evolution law, and there are a large set of such systems which are called cellular automata. Yes? Tell it to that. Tell that to your heart. Okay. But I will, you know, this is the beginning of a series of papers where he presents cellular automata models and attempts to realize this. And if you're interested, I would suggest looking into those. The discreteness of our degrees of freedom on a two surface strongly remind us of a 2 plus 1 dimensional cellular automata. But this would constitute a speculation on top of the previous one. There are various technical problems one has to face if such considerations were to be persecuted further. I think that's a rare misuse of English by a normally, you know, Dutch people normally have perfect English. But anyway, and he goes on and develops that. And there's another interesting little thing on page 6. So this is, again, he's making the argument I made. But then one may come to appreciate this result. It means that given any closed surface, we can represent all that happens inside of it by degrees of freedom on the surface itself. This, one may argue, suggests that quantum gravity should be described entirely by a topological quantum field theory in which all degrees of freedom, physical degrees of freedom, can be projected onto the boundary. Now, hold that thought, because remarkably, and I don't think they knew of each other, the work of Lewis Crane by about a year earlier had made a precise form of that suggestion with roughly the same motivation. So let me take the BlackBerry out of my pocket. Whoops. And let's look a little bit more at this paragraph and then turn to Lewis Crane. One Boolean variable per Planckian surface element should suffice. The fact that the total volume inside is irrelevant may be seen as a blessing, since it implies that we do not have to worry about the metric inside. The inside metric could be so much curved that an entire universe could be squeezed inside our closed surface, no matter how small it is. Now we see that this possibility will not add to the number of allowed states at all. Our results suggest that one should not worry about creating universes inside of test tubes. Another way to say what he's saying is that one doesn't know how to make sense of quantum gravity. Partly, it's hard enough to discuss what observables are in general relativity. But now imagine an infinite quantum superposition over geometries, and imagine how you're going to define degrees of freedom in them. And he's saying, well, maybe you don't have to worry about what it means to define a degree of freedom, not just even in a classical geometry, but in infinite superpositions of geometries quantum mechanically. OK. So Lewis Crane, as I said, starting about a year earlier, had developed that idea. And should I blow it up a little bit? OK, there. Is that better? Okay. And this is starting, I want to start at this point in Lewis's paper, because he does what is very rare in the quantum theory of gravity, which is he presents some principles. And I want to discuss those principles and then tell you something about their implementation. Lewis Crane is one of the most influential figures in the field of loop quantum gravity and spin foam models. And the main reason is that these ideas, although they're very indirectly and imperfectly realized, are really at the core of what we now call spin foam models. And in fact, the most studied spin foam model is a model called the Barrett-Crane model that was invented by Lewis Crane and John Barrett as an attempt to realize these ideas. So these have been very influential ideas. Okay, so I want to just talk through several of his principles, and then talk about their implementation. And keep in mind the argument for Atuf's holographic principle and Atuf's ideas. So one, no observation is possible without an observer. So he's taking there are various words for this in quantum mechanics, but in the foundation of quantum mechanics. But he's not taking what would normally be called a realist perspective, according to which the wave function is either real or not, independent of an observer. Okay. Hence, there is no Hilbert space associated with a closed universe. So in the standard formulation of quantum general relativity, as we've been discussing the case of a closed universe, and we set up a Hilbert space associated with the quantum states of a closed universe. And Lewis simply asserts that, in a closed universe, without the specification of an observer, there is no Hilbert space. So everything that we did in this class violates that principle. Any observer is part of a universe, hence occupies a three-manifold with boundary and makes observations on another such with a shared boundary. That is, what Lewis has in mind is that an observer, to discuss an observer in a closed universe, one has explicitly to draw a two-sphere. Let's assume that the universe is the three-sphere, although it won't matter what the topology is. One explicitly has to draw an S2 and divide the region where the observer is from the rest of the universe. And the observer will make contact with the rest of the universe through that boundary. And one has to imagine that boundary present to discuss an observer in a quantum theory of gravity. Okay? Questions, comments? The idea is that to discuss an observer, you'll see.
Observer in the rest of the universe, then, because
maybe no, you'll see. Okay. You'll see how he deals with that issue of that observer, because there could be another observer outside that boundary looking in. Okay, and wait. Okay, this is. I mean, you may decide that this is crazy, but hear him out. Principle two.
There is no observation at a distance. This is general relativity quantum mechanicalized. So there's no, you can't put a stick and, you know, talk about an observation made at the end of the stick. Thus, the Hilbert space in the theory reflects the interface between observer and system. This means that they are associated to surfaces. So the basic hypothesis, and Lewis is famous for writing mathematics papers, let alone physics papers like this, with no formulas or equations in them, with sentences that describe formulas. Okay? And then other people come along, like John Baez, and write 50 or 60 or 100 page papers explaining what it was exactly that Lewis had in mind. That's not really fair to John Baez. John has done many important things on his own besides that, but nonetheless. So the claim is, for a closed universe like S3, there's no Hilbert space. Okay? If you introduce an S2 into the S3, then the Hilbert space will be associated with that surface. That's the claim. And indeed, for every way to associate a surface into space that divides the universe, since we're assuming it's spatially compact, a surface will divide the universe into two parts, the inside and the outside. For every such surface, there will be a Hilbert space. Observers observe each other. But actually, before I say that, let me say something. In this case, there are actually two Hilbert spaces. There's a Hilbert space associated with the inside of the S2 and a Hilbert space associated with the outside of the S2. And that's how that symmetry is dealt with. There's a Hilbert space describing this observer's observations looking out, and is in the Hilbert space to describe the observations of observers looking in. Okay, so for each side of an orientable surface, there are observers. Okay. We'll come to that. We will come to that. There is a relation between them. Or let me just tell you now, the relationship is that they're conjugates to each other. So H of some surface inside is the dual of H of the surface outside. He's not stating that here, but that's a consequence of this and several of the other principles. So there live here states, and there live here dual states in the language of quantum mechanics, bras and cats. Okay? Observers observe each other. Hence, there are linear maps between the Hilbert spaces attached to surfaces in the same three-manifold. So what he has in mind is supposing that there's a surface here, and supposing that we're on the outside looking in. Let me call that S1. And supposing, although it's really an S2, but forgive me, supposing there's another surface, S2, contained in that. An observer looking through S2, let's call that observer 2 and observer 1, looking through S1. An observer looking through S2 is making observations available on the surface of information coming from the interior, available on that surface S2. And observer 1 is making observations of the larger system, which includes S2 plus some other stuff. And the hypothesis is, and I'm going to state these, there's a very beautiful formal mathematical language for this that I will state, but the physical idea is that for any two surfaces that divide space into two parts like this, there is a Hilbert space H1 and a Hilbert space H2, and there are some maps that go between the two Hilbert spaces. We'll discuss that. He just says here that they will satisfy some natural consistency conditions, and he doesn't write them down here. They are written down later in the paper. But for example, if there are three, then you would expect that U1-3 is U1-2 composed with U2-3, for example. Okay. Principle 4, states for quantum gravity can be embedded, can be described by embedded graphs or knots. That's from loop quantum gravity, which we've discussed. Hence, the assignments of Hilbert spaces and maps above can be extended to surfaces with punctures and three manifolds with graphs which end on the punctures of their boundaries. So what he has in mind is that I might have on this two surface a set of punctures. These are points labeled by representations. Remember, if we're doing loop quantum gravity, there's a group and the representation theory of the group. Labeled by representations. And there's a Hilbert space associated with the surface and the choice of representations on the punctures. And then the states are going to be related to spin network graphs in the interior that have free edges that meet the punctures carrying those representation labels. so the puncture with representation J3 has to be met by an edge coming from a spin network in the interior with an edge labeled by the same representation J3. So we're getting some structure here. Five, general relativity is diffeomorphism invariant. Hence, all the above assignments depend only on topological type. Okay. Now, what he means by that is quite precise, and I'll draw it. Let me draw a slightly different view. Here's my surface, S. Let me sort of turn the picture around a little bit. Here's a compact S3. Here's a surface S2 dividing the S3 into region 1 and region 2. Okay. I can also draw it like this. Here's the surface, the S2. Here's region 1, say, a three-dimensional space-time with a boundary, a three-dimensional manifold with a boundary. Here are some punctures. And R1 might have itself some topology of various kinds. And R1 will have also within it some graphs, some spin network graphs. Okay. And the claim is the following. For every surface of some topology, two-dimensional surface, and set of punctures, there is a Hilbert space associated with that surface and that set of punctures. And for every three manifold, R and a spin network graph in it, such that their boundary is the two surface with the set of punctures, that the boundary or graph are the punctures where the graph ends on the boundary, the points where the graph ends on the boundary. For every one of those, there is a state defined by the three manifold and the graph in that Hilbert space, defined by the two-dimensional surface. So the properties of the two-dimensional surface define the Hilbert space, label the Hilbert space. And the two-dimensional surface with the let me say it first, the two-dimensional surface can be the boundary of a three-dimensional manifold. And forgetting the punctures, the claim is that for every three-manifold that bounds that surface, there is a state in the Hilbert space associated with that surface. And furthermore, for every graph and three manifold that bounds the surface, there is a state in the Hilbert space associated with that surface in those set of punctures. Okay. And these are defined up to topological type. That is, all that matters is the topology of the three manifold and the topology of the embedding of the graph in the three manifold. Okay?
Yes, the graph lives in the three manifold. Now, this assignment of Hilbert spaces for two-dimensional surfaces and states for three manifolds of topological type that have a boundary which is the two-dimensional surfaces is at the heart of the construction of what's called the topological field theory. And let me depart a little bit. We'll come back to a few more of his principles. But the key idea is it works like this. given a two surface, is a Hilbert space associated with the one side, H1, and the Hilbert space, which is its dual, associated with the other side. So, given the topology over here, and I'll say it just for topology, but the same thing holds true for the graphs, there is a state associated with R1 over here, which lives in the Hilbert space associated with that surface. There is a dual state. These are bras. There is a dual state associated with the topology of the other side of the three manifold, because the two surface has divided the three manifold into two pieces, R1 and R2, which have boundaries that reflect into each other under change of orientation. Okay. Associated, each one gives, you get a Hilbert space of bras and the dual Hilbert space cats. Given the topology on this side, you get a state in that Hilbert space. And given the topology on this side, you get a state in the dual Hilbert space, a cat. Because of the natural pairing of Hilbert spaces and dual spaces, given the bra and the ket, that is given the whole three manifold, you get a number. Because in quantum mechanics, if you have a state, a bra, and a dual state, which is a ket, you put them together, and you get, and there's a natural operation that gives you a number. Wait, let me finish the discussion, okay? So associated with the whole three manifold is a number, which was computed by cutting it in two, assigning Hilbert spaces for the surface that divided it two, associating states in those Hilbert spaces for the topology on each side, and you put it together, and quantum mechanics gives you a number. Okay. Now, the beauty of the subject of topological field theory is there's a short list of axioms, which I'll give you in a few minutes, okay, such that this number is a topological invariant. That is, it's the same number if I use a different surface to divide the space into two. And therefore, you can use quantum mechanics plus these associations to compute topological invariance. And this is an important mathematical subject, is the subject of topological field theory. And this is the outline of how it works. And it, as of this time, that is the early 90s, it had been mostly developed in the case of three dimensions, as we're talking about. What Lewis is proposing in this paper, okay, is that this is the core of a quantum theory of gravity, motivated, as if you read the paper, motivated by the same considerations of Bekenstein and black holes and so forth. The same basic idea that information is on surfaces, quantum states are on surfaces, associated with the whole of a space-time is not a Hilbert space, is not a state, but is just a number, okay? And then extended by these graphs. So if you want to measure something in a quantum state, okay, thanks, in loop quantum gravity, you have to measure something incomplete. You have to measure something about the state on one side of a boundary. All you get by putting the whole picture together is a number, which is a topological invariant. Yeah. Well, the math at this point has been developed at 2 plus 1.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
It has since, okay, so let me just, the mathematics has since been developed for the 3 plus 1 dimensional context. And spin foam models are closely related to how this mathematics was developed for the 3+1 dimensional context.
Because axioms, in fact, you put them in 2+1, and then it's better because it's 3+1.
Yes, and then it becomes, and this is why the word clocks, the title of this paper is Clocks and Categories, is quantum gravity algebraic. And the clocks refers to the notion of time coming in from extending this to its structures in space, as we've been talking about, to structures in space-time, where the boundary now is a three-manifold, which is the history of the boundary in space-time. Yes. So what I'm talking about is 2+1, and what Lewis is talking about is 2+1. I'm sorry, it's 3, without time. And then there's a proposal later on in this paper to extend this. So this is a correspondence about space of three manifolds, associated with three manifolds and pieces of three manifolds. There's a proposal about space-time, which is coming, but we're not there yet. The extension of this to three plus one dimensions was not do the same thing one dimension up.
Okay,
it was to add a layer of structure to this.
So in the extension, you keep two-dimensionality.
Yes. Yeah, it was to add a layer of structure to this.
But in spin form, they actually have two-dimensional
space. And spin foams follow this, right? Spin foams added the layer of structure that he wants to add. But let me come to this. But these ideas, I don't pretend are easy. So let me build them up bit by bit. Yes?
Is that where you expect to get the local degrees of freedom from?
There are no local degrees of freedom. There are degrees of freedom on two surfaces associated with the imposition of observers. This is not a realist formulation of quantum mechanics or quantum gravity. The claim is that if you want to do quantum mechanics in space-time, you have to say, I have an observer, I am an observer, since it's general relativistic, I can only make observations, I build a shell around me. What I'm doing, he's very explicit about this, is he's relativizing Copenhagen. Copenhagen said there's a boundary between the quantum world and the classical world. We and our measuring instruments live in the classical world and we make measurements on the quantum world. Okay. Where is the boundary where we need it to be for the experiment? Moore said some vague things about you can put the boundary wherever you like and you're still doing quantum mechanics. What Crane is doing explicitly, okay, is relativizing that. He is saying quantum mechanics is a theory about the consequences of putting that boundary, and you put that boundary anywhere you like. And he's even going to give a theory, that's what these maps are, of the relationship between observers, observations made by different observers who put the boundary in different places, which is only something that you can discuss informally in Bohr.
Here you can, there's a formal mathematical structure that tells you what you can say about observations made on one boundary between the quantum and the classical world versus observations made on another boundary in the quantum and classical world. A and B, okay, is a very important part of the structure, is that there's a relationship between the Hilbert, if you make side R1 classical and R2 quantum, so you're making observations from R1 to R2, or the reverse, both are contemplated, and there's a precise relationship between the quantum mechanics of region 1 classically seeing region 2 quantum mechanically in the reverse, which is that the Hilbert spaces are dual to each other.
Don't you want local degrees of freedom?
The claim of the whole argumentation is that it doesn't make any sense to talk of. The claim of Etchofen, Crane, and Susskind, we're not reading Susskind right now, is it doesn't make any sense because local degrees of freedom, quote, live somewhere, and when the quantum geometry is fluctuating quantum mechanically, you don't even know what the topology of the interior is. So you don't know, quote, where the degrees of freedom might live, so there's no sense. The only sense to talking about degrees of freedom from this point of view is degrees of freedom on the quantum classical boundary that you impose.
Yeah. Here in Brazilian topology, Marion means that it doesn't depend on the topology of the R1 and R2, the end that we get from the operation. And so let's say, I mean, because here we have S2, but we can have another S2 which has, I mean, intersection with this one. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in the intersection, they see different things, but they have the same value.
Mm-hmm.
How come it?
How can that happen?
Yeah.
There's a set of mathematical axioms which are realized precisely in a whole class of models within which that happens. And if I get there, I'll either this time or next time, I'll get to state those. There's a precise mathematical statement that governs that. Okay. Let me, there's more to say, but I want to just note axiom 7, the Hamiltonian for general relativity is 0, hence there is no time evolution for states in themselves. The core theory is three-dimensional. The experience of time evolution in the world must be described by treating variables in the theory as local clocks. There are no global clocks. And so here he's making an assertion of the issue of time and the disappearance of time and so forth, which is part of this set of conjectures. Okay.
Can I ask a question about that?
Sure.
If the Hamiltonian is zero, then you use certain observation, let's say binary pulsar, where you're actually measuring the emission of gravitational radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So the Hamiltonian is zero, and the states don't evolve, does that mean that as the quantum pulsar continues to wind down, the quantum mechanical state is remaining the same?
Yes. That's what it means. That's what it means. And I know that's problematic. I know it's very problematic, but that's part of what we're talking about here. Okay. Now then he makes a claim. And there are acronyms here. The Churn-Simon-Witten topological quantum field theory is a particular topological quantum field theory, provides exactly what we have just specified as a model for quantum gravity, except for the local clocks. Okay. And if I have your permission, what I'd like to do for the next half an hour is spell out precisely what is the math. I'm not going to spell out. I'm going to sketch precisely what is the math behind these assertions. One, because it becomes a language that I want to use later, and two, because it's a framework for a proposal about the problem of time, and three, because it's really beautiful. Okay. So, any more comments on Lewis's principles before I try to show you the mathematics? Any comment from Weston? Okay. You're still stunned. Okay, so let's turn. Let's see if we can.
Who is CSW?
Turn Simon Witten. System shut down. Shut down video only. And I hope you don't lose all the video at this point out there. Yes?
Does Crane specify what he means by observer?
No, just like for Bohr, it's a formal notion. It is a division of the world into quantum and classical. And we're now putting the computer to sleep. Thank you. And let's introduce some philosophical mathematics. So the language for the mathematics is category theory, and let me remind people, or if you have not heard this before, tell you what a category is, and then we're going to talk about a particular kind of category. And let me note in passing that there are people who believe that this provides a better foundation for mathematics and for logic than does set theory. So there's a lot of depth to these ideas. A category consists of a list of objects, which you can write as points, and arrows, or relations, which are arrows that point. From objects to other objects. And there are the obvious rules, like if there are three objects, and an arrow is also called a map, is also called a morphism, that if there's an arrow from A to B and an arrow from B to C, there is by composition an arrow from A to C. And there's a set of simple rules which constrain those things. Okay. For example, there is the category called VEC, in which the objects are vector spaces, and for simplicity, let's call them, let's say, finite dimensional vector spaces. So these ABCs refer to any finite dimensional vector space. And the arrows are linear maps. Okay, and that's a category and it satisfies. I have not written quite all the axioms of category theory. But that's a nice category that satisfies all the axioms of category theory. Okay. Now, there are categories which have additional properties. I mean, category theory has been called abstract nonsense because it's so general. But very quickly, it gets precise and interesting by adding additional properties. So notice that there's the notion of a tensor product. In vector spaces, given vector spaces V1 and V2, there is another vector space, which is the tensor product of V1 and V2. So categories which allow the product of objects being other objects are called tensor categories. And under tensor product, the linear maps come along in a natural way. And you can write those conditions, and those are part of the definition of a tensor category. Okay. So let me tell you about another category, which is a category from topology, which is also a tensor category. Let me tell you about the category which is called two cobordism. Okay. Consider as objects compact, orientable two surfaces. So the objects are the sphere, S2, T2,
surfaces with five holes in them, etc. Okay. The morphisms are cobordisms. And what does that mean? A morphism from one surface to another surface is a three-manifold. M, such that the boundary of M is S1 plus the reverse orientation. So there is another structure. Given these objects, there is a map from objects to objects which take you to their orientation reversal. And so let me write that as star. So S star is orientation reversal because these are oriented surfaces. And I have a cobordism from S1 to S2. If I have a three-manifold which has two components for its boundaries, one of which is S1, and the other one is the backward side of S2. So for example, if I have S2 cross a piece of the real line, I'll write it one dimension down. That's a cylinder. And that's a three-manifold whose boundary is two manifolds, which is S2. Okay? And that works under composition. If there's a morphism from S1 to S2 and a morphism from S2 to S3, if there's a three-manifold whose boundaries are S1 and the reversal of S2, and another three-manifold whose boundaries are S2 and the reversal of S3, then by putting them together, there's a three-manifold which is a cobordism whose boundaries take you from S1 to S3. So the arrows compose, as they should, in a category. So this is a category. And it is also a tensor category because I can take the product of two surfaces, S1 and S2, and that's merely putting them side by side because that's an oriented compact two surface. Okay? Questions? We're almost there. Okay. Now, one of the powerful ideas in category theory is a functor. A functor is a map between two categories, category one and category two, that takes objects, say A, B, C, takes the objects, let's call the objects here little a, b, and c, takes the objects to the objects, and takes the morphisms to the morphisms, such that if these are two objects in the first category and these are two objects in the second category, and there's a morphism or an arrow there, and there's an arrow there, the following diagram commutes. I can use the functor to map from this to its corresponding object, and then the arrow to map within that category. Or I can first map within the first category and then use the functor like that. So such that that diagram is commutative. And a few other axioms again. Okay? That's called a functor. It sets up a correspondence or an equivalence between categories. Now, these categories both are tensor categories, and they're also tensor categories with another structure, and I apologize, I forget the name of this. They both have a duality. Given vectors, given a vector space, there's a dual vector space, and given an orientable surface, there's a surface with a reverse orientation. So they both have an object, they both have an operation that squares to one, which is a duality. And so these are tensor categories with duality, only there's some name for that, but I apologize, I don't remember. Okay. Definition, a topological quantum field theory is a functor from the cobordism category in some dimension. This actually works for any dimension, but let me say two because that's the one we've been using. That is, I could have had objects which were d-dimensional manifolds for any dimension and joined them by cobordisms which were manifolds one dimension up. This is general, but let me stick to the two-dimensional case. A topological quantum field theory in three dimensions is a functor from two cobordism, which is a category, to VEC, to the category of vector spaces. Period. That's the definition of a topological quantum field theory. What do you get from that? You get everything that Lewis said. Given a compact two surface, you get a vector, so let's call that S. You get a vector space, VS, which is finite dimensional. Remember, these are finite dimensional vector spaces. Given reverse orientation, you get from the vector space to the dual space. Given a cobordism, you have here, here's a surface S1, and there's a vector space S1. Here's a surface S2. There's a vector space S2. Here's a manifold, a three manifold of particular topology, which has these two boundaries. And there's a linear map between those vector spaces. Moreover, you can show from these axioms that if you have a vector space, of course, is a vector space over a field, let's say the complex numbers. Okay? And one can show from what's here, but I won't give the proof, that given a point which is a degenerate manifold, it's a manifold that you product it with another manifold and you still get that other manifold. Okay. What you get assigned is the one-dimensional vector space, which is the field of the complex numbers. So what that means is given a surface, which is the only boundary of a manifold, of a three manifold, that means that you get a map from the complex numbers into the vector space associated with that surface.
Categories only allow elements of two dimensions.
What do you mean, only allow elements?
I mean, this is a two cobordism category. All the objects in there.
What I mean is no manifold at all. I mean something that you product with another manifold to get it back itself.
So this, in the tensor category, this acts like an identity element. And the thing that acts like that in the tensor category of vector spaces is the field that the vector spaces are over. Okay. So it follows already from what's set up that if I have no manifold at all, I get associated with it the complex number. Therefore, by the definitions, if I have a manifold with one boundary, that manifold with one boundary gives me a map from the complex numbers, which is the vector space associated with no boundary, and the vector space associated with that map. That is, I get a state up to an overall complex number. So I get a ray in Hilbert space, which is exactly right for quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics states are not vectors in Hilbert space. They're vectors in Hilbert space up to multiplication by an arbitrary complex number. And it follows that given, and now it's a theorem that's easy to show. That if I have two surfaces, S1 and S2, by the composition, what do I have here? I have a map from the complex numbers into the Hilbert space associated with V1. I have a map U associated with this manifold M between S1 and S2 into the Hilbert space associated with the surface V2. And I have a map to the complex numbers again associated with the dual of the surface here and nothing. So I have a map from the complex numbers to the complex numbers, okay, which is a number, basically. So associated with a closed manifold, I have a complex number, just from the axioms. And does it matter how I divide it up? No, because by composition of the arrows, I could have gone directly from here to here and not had that surface. Or I could have gone from here to here directly to there and not stopped at that surface. And all those, and going from here to here to here to here has to be the same as going from here to here to here, or from here to here to here by composition of the maps. Okay. So therefore, it doesn't matter where I draw the surfaces in the middle or how many surfaces I draw in the middle. Yeah.
Have a map from the complex to the complex.
No, if you were God, the mythical observer outside the universe, okay, then there's a complex number associated, it's not a Hilbert space, there's a one-dimensional Hilbert space associated with your knowledge of that universe.
It's the universe.
Yeah, and you have exactly one, you know, complex numbers worth of information about it, which is, in the mathematics, that's in the philosophy, in the mathematics you have a topological invariant. By the way, this is a very powerful technique for constructing topological invariants in 3 and 4 dimensions. Just the pure mathematics alone of this is a very significant thing. And the pure mathematics alone of this existed in the 3-dimensional case before Lewis was writing this paper. He is somebody who contributed to it, but there were, you know, a dozen other people who were very significant. Among them, Ed Witten, Chern and Simons, not directly, but the governing example, the explicit example of this is something called Chern and Simons with field theory. Yeah.
Here, if two S1 in this, two S1 and S2 have a kind of cross section in the middle. And then you don't have that M to map from that side to the other side. So
you mean if they intersect?
Yeah.
It works out. There's still, you're going, it works out. You go home and think about it.
Sure.
It works out.
What was it again that told us that the field was C?
If you what?
What was it that told us that the field was the complex numbers?
I told you that.
Okay, was there any reason?
No. So let me say a topological quantum field theory is a functor from two cohomorphisms to back over the complexes. I told you that. I apologize if it made that clear. You could have the same structure with the reals or the quaternions or the octonions if you could do it. Now, the claim is the claim about quantum gravity just has one more step in it. And I'm sorry, two more steps, and then I'm going to stop. There's also a category of given a group, G is a category of two surfaces with punctures labeled by representations of G. Where the objects are two surfaces labeled by representations of G, and the arrows, or the morphisms, are three manifolds which with spin networks embedded in them. Okay, so this is a category called two cobord with spin networks. Okay. The objects are two surfaces with marked points labeled by reps of the group G. So these are two cobordisms with spin networks associated with the group G. The morphisms are three manifolds with spin networks embedded. And so when I take a boundary, as I said before, I take a boundary of the three manifold to get a two manifold, and I take a boundary of the spin network embedded by looking at edges that end on the surface, and they have to end at these special points, marked points, which are sometimes called punctures. And you can show that that is the category, and it's a tensor category, and under reversal of orientation, a representation goes to the complex conjugate representation. And now I've told you everything you need to know about that. And then the conjecture of Crane, or I guess this is about physics, this is a hypothesis. Is that a quantum theory of gravity is a functor from this category, two cobord with SU2 spin nets, two vec over the complexes, okay, with one more condition, that the dimension of the vector space associated with the surface and a list of punctures is the exponential of the area which loop quantum gravity would give to that surface. Because remember, there's an area operator in loop quantum gravity which assigns an area to a surface which is punctured by spin networks. And the area is the sum of the square roots of the jj plus 1 of the areas. It's the area which is a function of the punctures over 4g h bar. And notice that that builds in the Bekenstein relation as part of the definition. That is, not just that there's a correspondence of finite dimensional vector spaces to surfaces which have some topology and some set of punctures with labels, but you go to a specific dimension complex Hilbert space where the dimension is the dimension that you need according to Bekenstein to code the information on the surface of that area. Okay. So that's Crane's definition of a quantum theory of gravity. And I think you see it very naturally fits the form of the flavor of the holographic hypothesis as formulated by Atulf, but it's much more precise. It's much more precise because it tells you what it tells you that the surfaces are any surfaces that you want. It tells you that your attitude towards the surfaces is an extension, a relativization of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, where there's a quantum world and a classical world. It tells you what the Hilbert spaces are on the surfaces. It tells you if you put surfaces in different places, what's the relationship between the states on one Hilbert space and the states on another Hilbert space. You move the boundary around. So it's a precise implementation of what Atulf was thinking, in my opinion. And it's a precise definition of what the mathematical structure of a quantum theory of gravity could be. Okay, so I'm going to stop there for today. Let's just take a few comments. Anybody comments out there? Are you still stuck at Western out there? No, but you shouldn't have that point of view. Your point of view should be, so what did you guys do since 1993? That should be your question. Well, there you go. I mean, all this, the category theory, all this was 1993. Yeah. All this. I mean, this particular paper is 1995. The relationship, the definition of the topological quantum field theory given here goes back to Atiya and Graham Siegel in the late 80s, 87, 88. The construction of what's called Schoen-Simon-Witten theory is 88, 89. There's work by, again, half a dozen or a dozen mathematicians investigating the properties of these objects from the late 80s onward. And the identification of this structure with 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum gravity, which is something we haven't talked about yet, was, again, 1988, 89. So, no, everything I'm saying was in place by 1993, 1994. The question that Crane's paper raised was, can you introduce, this is so far a timeless picture, can you introduce time by adding another dimension to it, and not by going up one dimension and doing the same thing in one dimension, that is Hilbert spaces on 2 plus 1 dimensional surfaces and maps on 4 dimensional surfaces. But can you build another layer of structure on top of this, which keeps all of this and adds another layer of maps moving around, relating some higher objects, higher dimensional, to go, in other words, to describe the 4 dimensional space-time, you wanted to go up in algebra. And that going up in algebra is called categorification. And it then was both a project in mathematics
leading to the construction of some non-trivial topological quantum field theories in four dimensions, and a project in physics leading to the construction of the spin foam models that we use. There are lots of developments in that area, and let's stop here. And if people are finding this interesting, I'll continue next time with some things about this. Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much.